I want to welcome everyone to the 426th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, both to our members and guests here today and to our public radio audience, reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from Northport, Maine, and I'm George Look, president of the Forum. The Forum was founded in 1983 as a citizens' forum for study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of foreign policies. We're now in our 36th year of monthly meetings, featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of U.S. foreign policy. To listen to past forum presentations, or to find out about upcoming forum programs, visit our website at midcoastforum.org. We're very pleased today to have with us Dr. Susan Purcell, who will be addressing the question, will there be a regime change in Venezuela? Dr. Susan Purcell is an independent consultant on Latin America. She is a recognized authority on Latin America and has done extensive consulting on Latin American economic, trade, investment, and political issues. She has written, co-authored, or co-edited 11 books, over 200 articles on Latin America, and has been a frequent commentator on U.S. and Latin American television. Previously, she was director of the Center for Hemispheric Policy at the University of Miami and Vice President of the Council of the Americas. She was also a Senior Fellow and Director of the Latin American Project at the Council on Foreign Relations. Prior to that, Dr. Purcell was a member of the State Department's Policy Planning Staff during the Carter and Reagan administrations. Before joining the U.S. government, she was a tenured professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles. In addition, Dr. Purcell was a director of Valero Energy Corporation from 1994 to 2018 and has served on a number of nonprofit boards, including the National Endowment for Democracy, Freedom House, and the International Women's Forum. She holds a master's and doctorate degree in political science from Columbia University and a bachelor degree in Spanish and Latin American literature from Barnard College. Susan, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you, George Look, and I want to thank also Joanne Bander, my hostess these last few days. It's not on? I guess I inadvertently pressed the button. I got a wonderful opportunity to see a lot of Maine, which is absolutely, as you all know, beautiful. Plus, my daughter and son-in-law are together alumni of Colby College, and so I was able to revisit the campus that I got to know well when they were at college. In any case, I'm very pleased to have this opportunity to address all of you on basically the possibility for regime change, but even a little broader than that, in the sense that the basic question is, what's going on in Venezuela and how will it end in a way? So that's putting it at its most basic. I'll address three main questions. Why did the United States decide to get involved in Venezuela when it did? And the second part of the talk will be about the aspects of U.S. policy toward Venezuela. And the third will be possible scenarios looking ahead. So why did the U.S. decide to get actively involved? Now, this was a result of developments both inside Latin America, within Latin America, and also within the United States. It was the interplay of these both kinds of developments. In Latin America, you had the end of the commodities boom, more or less about 2010, led to low oil prices. The commodities boom basically benefited South America, which is almost entirely a commodities-producing area, and the oil is one of the main ones, and so once the commodities boom ended, the price of oil dropped. Venezuela at the time, depending on what you read, was either 90, its economy was either 90 or 95% dependent on oil. So you can imagine that this created a kind of crisis in the Venezuelan economy, which weakened significantly. Hugo Chavez, a former military man who first tried to make a military coup in 1992, and he got jailed, and then I guess the very good-hearted Venezuelan president at the time, 2 years later, let him free, and so he began plotting an electoral comeback. And this is not the first time in Latin America that somebody, a military man who tried to make a coup and failed, decides he will then try and get elected. And more often than not, it did work. In any case, President Chavez then used his election, and he was as most of you may have heard or know, he was a very charismatic person. He just could make this direct connection with the poor people of Venezuela. And they just trusted him, no matter what. And he spoke in a language that was somewhat different from the duly elected presidents beforehand, because he seemed to be very, very concerned with the poor. And he was, if you take it in a relative situation. On the other hand, as usually happens, those with the most money got the most. And the system was corrupt to start with, so it became even more corrupt as a result. But this time, part of it at least trickled down in the form of social welfare benefits. Unfortunately for Venezuela, or maybe fortunately, we'll see how it plays out, Chavez died unexpectedly, they say, of cancer. There's even some controversy as to when he died. He died in Cuba, and there's some rumor, which may be wrong, that they held off because they wanted to pick the ideal day to announce that Chavez had died. But in any case, his successor is Maduro, who is a former bus driver. He was handpicked, I guess, because he was pliable. Basically, Maduro, I doubt, is calling the shots in this situation. And he had the bad luck to preside over a Venezuelan economy that was getting poorer and poorer. And the economy worsened, tremendous food shortages developed, there was a breakdown of even the most basic government services, and spiraling inflation. So the reason I mention all of these things, and these were things that were not only, it was the coming together of the end of the commodities boom with a regime that didn't know what to do about the economy, and they knew how to spend, but they didn't know how to do much of anything else. They knew how to redistribute, but they didn't know how to do much else beyond that. So things kept getting worse. But now the other development that had a big impact on the decision of the United States to get more involved with Venezuela is the election of Donald Trump. He was much more concerned with security threats to the United States and to the economic and political development process and potential future stability of Latin America. One of the most concerning aspects from the point of view of the Trump administration was the expanding influence and presence of outside powers, usually outside of the hemisphere, except for one, which I'll talk about, that were regarded as hostile to U.S. security interests. And these included Russia, Iran, China, and in the Latin American category, Cuba. And so that was a concern for a variety of reasons. I'll talk about it in a second. But I do want to say something about the difference in the Trump approach to what was happening with the presence of the foreign powers and the Obama approach. It's important because these are two strains that are very opposite in U.S. foreign policy and in terms of the assessment of a situation, the priorities, and what the policies are that follow. And so my sense, this is my interpretation of it, obviously, that under the Obama administration, it was a more liberal-looking policy. And this basically meant that there was this belief that if countries were hostile to us, you could help undercut or reduce the hostility by being nicer to them, because there was this underlying assumption, sometimes stated, sometimes not, that the anger of these countries, the hostility toward the United States, was because of terrible things that the United States had done to them. So that was one part of it. The second part of it is that if you enable them to keep developing, even though they're hostile, that there's some kind of inexorable force in terms of economic development leads to political development, which that's a short way of saying democracy. So I even I learned this in graduate school, that this approach was very prevalent then. And so you don't, for example, you end the embargo, or you try and end the embargo on Cuba, you try and get rid of a lot of the sanctions, you encourage investment, you encourage cruise ships, you encourage, et cetera, in Cuba, on the assumption that as Cuba got richer, it would become less hostile, more economically prosperous, and we would have better relations. That's almost diametrically opposed from how Trump looked at it. I mentioned, okay. So Trump, in a sense, refused to accept the guilt, or the guilt trip, or whatever you want to call it. He didn't feel that the hostility was a result of U.S. policy that was detrimental to these countries. And he believed that if you treat dictatorships kindly, they interpret that as weakness, and that they will therefore take advantage of your weakness. And so the nicer you try to be to them, the more they will respond by being more aggressive. Maybe not directly aggressive, but aggressive toward your interests, such as maybe they won't be aggressive toward you, but they'll get involved somewhere where you have interests and things like that, and make life harder for you. So the best way from that, it follows that the best way to react to expanding hostile countries is to cut off their access to resources. And then it leads you to different kinds of policies, such as economic sanctions. So Cuba is an example. Tighten the embargo, increase sanctions to reduce the hostile country's access to aid, to hard currency, in order to weaken the dictatorship. And initially, Cuba wasn't thrown in the hopper with Russia and China and Iran, but the more recent addition was to say, you know, isn't it about time we focus on the dictatorship right here in our hemisphere, that without whose help the Venezuela dictatorship could not prosper. To give you some example of what Cuba was doing and has been doing, they have provided military aid, military people, Cuban military, counterintelligence people from the Cuban military and elsewhere, and Cuban doctors, this whole doctor program, they do some doctoring, but they're all armed, and they're all told to, if there's any kind of insurrection or something like that, you know, they need to report and take care of it. Iran started round trip flights, I think they were every week or two, that no one knew what was in these planes because they were not checked in the airports. They just went to some special place and unloaded. The assumption is, or maybe there's proof, I'm not too sure of this, but these flights were not open to international Venezuelan civilian inspectors. And so they apparently were bringing in Russian arms. And also the Iranians were going throughout rural areas of Cuba saying they were interested in farming or something like that, but that they went to where the uranium deposits were because Venezuela has decent uranium deposits. All right, China loaned billions of dollars to Venezuela with Venezuelan oil as the collateral, and now with Venezuela's much decreased production, they still have to keep paying China what they owe them in return for the loans. And I think the other reason, besides these four hostile categorized countries by the Trump administration, Trump didn't want what was called another Mariel, because in 1980, Fidel Castro decided that there were a lot of opponents to his regime, and the best thing would be to let them emigrate. And so word got out that if you went to the Peruvian embassy in Havana, that you could escape the country. And so I don't even know the number, but it was a very, thousands of Cubans went. And they were the first wave that basically came to Florida. And I guess originally it was to Georgia. I'm not sure about that. But in any case, so Trump didn't want to see thousands of Venezuelans coming to the United States. One other factor that became a part of this policy, of this decision to pay more attention and to try and do something about what was happening in Venezuela, was the so-called fracking revolution in the United States. And this was the discovery and application of new technology that involved cracking rocks, adding some kind of chemical mixture to it to make it easier, break it up, and then do horizontal drilling, where instead of drilling holes all over the place to find the oil, you can just dig one hole that would go along the cracks in the stratified rock, which today, by the way, this whole fracking revolution has made the United States the number one oil producer in the world, more than Saudi Arabia now. And as a result, the United States is no longer dependent, could afford cutting off its access to Venezuelan oil, or cutting off Venezuelan access to the U.S. market. So that made a big difference, too. So all of these things came together, one or two other things. The rise of Guaido, the new opposition leader, different generation. If I remember correctly, he's 35 years old. He was the elected head of the National Assembly. And so the United States, together with elements of the opposition, declared him the legitimate president, because Maduro's regime was not legitimate. He kept changing the rules and packing the institutions, et cetera. And then within Latin America, more or less at this time, you had a shift from a dominance of a more left of center wave. That was when Lula was president in Brazil, for example. And these are all elected regimes that then were replaced by elected presidents who were more conservative. For example, I mentioned Lula in Brazil. He was replaced by Jair Bolsonaro, who is a former military man who spent, I think, about 20 years in the Brazilian National Assembly. He didn't play a particularly active role. And he suddenly decided to run when things were going really bad after the commodities boom, et cetera. And he was seen as the Brazilian Trump and as a disruptor. And he was elected, too, in a surprise outcome. Colombia, which had been governed by Juan Manuel Santos, after his term ended, Iván Duque came in, current president of Colombia. He is close to Álvaro Uribe, who was the right-of-center Colombian president, who was very effective in undermining the guerrilla presence. Couldn't get rid of it, but undermined it. Chile, Michelle Bachelet, who was more left of center. She was a socialist. She wasn't any kind of radical socialist. But she was replaced by Sebastián Piñera, who is a conservative businessman. Interestingly, both of them had been in the same coalition, a several-party coalition, and this was the second time each of them had been reelected. When they're going to decide to change away and go into some younger people is another issue. And then in Argentina, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, she's out. She was out, but we see she's still there in the papers and in the gossip, and replaced by Marcelo Macri, who is a businessman. And so the big difference between left and right is the social base and more of a market economy approach on the part of the more rightist candidates. And the leftist ones are more in favor of redistribution, higher taxes against the people who are rich, and a bigger role for the state in the economy. I think those are, and much more regulation. It's when I started graduate school years ago, the Latins always used to say to me, oh, you know, your politics is so boring. There's no difference between the Republican and the Democratic parties. And I laugh at it now, and I always have to mention it because it is It is different now. So that's an understatement, obviously. And then the last thing was that within the Trump administration, there was an important group of people who thought that if the United States didn't act to stop the further consolidation of these foreign powers and the Maduro or the Chavista regime, this was our last chance to stop it. It had already gone pretty far. Okay, the key elements of U.S. policy. I forgot to look at what time I started, George. Would you tell me? Okay, recognize Guaido as the legitimate president and support him. Tightening sanctions against Maduro regime, remove visas from hundreds of people, government officials, bureaucrats, members of Maduro's inner circle. Ended U.S. imports of oil from Venezuela. This is first starting in April, so you can't expect much of an impact yet, but we'll see if it has much going forward. Embargoed funds earned by Citgo, which Venezuela owns, but this is a Citgo in Texas, and PDVSA, and let the funds, direct the funds to accounts for Guaido and the opposition, so that the opposition would have some money to pay for policies. Put together an international support group for a democratic transition in Venezuela. There are about 50 plus countries, mainly from Latin America, the European Union, Canada, I think Australia, but I'm not sure. Most recent, cruise ships can't dock anymore without some kind of sanctions. And if other countries from outside of the hemisphere do business with Cuba by ship, then they can't dock in U.S. In U.S. ports for, I don't know if it's 6 months or a number of months. And then the most recent thing that it did was it, for years now, there were portions of the so-called Helms-Burton law which required certain kinds of sanctions against countries dealing with Cuba. They had been waived throughout several U.S. administrations up through the Obama administration, and the Trump administration decided to stop waiving the exemptions from the sanctions. And so now Cubans and Cuban Americans who had properties confiscated in Cuba as a result of the revolution can now sue the owners of the properties and get some kind of compensation for the properties having been confiscated. And the U.S. is giving some help basically to Colombia and to Brazil for the humanitarian crisis, because Colombia in particular is being overwhelmed by refugees as a neighboring country who are coming from Venezuela. There are other refugees going to the rest of Latin America, and then people coming, the reports are now showing people from all over, from the Middle East, from India, et cetera, who see that they can get to the U.S. border, and that, especially if they're carrying a child with them, then they can't be turned back. So there's some trafficking involved, too, in these fake families that are picking up children somehow or other. And there's an estimate that up till now, 3.5 million Venezuelans have left. They're refugees, they're settling elsewhere or trying to reach the United States. The highest estimate I've seen as to what might happen by the end of the year, it sounds a little high to me, but up to 10 million Venezuelans will have left. I mean, because the economy is now in total freefall. Combination of the very inept economic management and poor economic policies implemented by the Maduro administration, combined with the impact of the sanctions. The low oil price it's only part of what makes the oil situation worse for Venezuela. The other is a failure of maintenance during years and years of the oil wells. And many of you know Venezuela has among the heaviest weight oil. It's like sludge. And so if you don't take care of your wells, the wells just gunk up with all kinds of, and it's going to take a lot to get those wells back. But right now they're down to under half the production of oil that they had. This is a country that used to be I mean, I guess it was since the 20s when oil was found there. I mean, it was like, it was the Saudi Arabia of the Americas. And now, I mean, in such a short time, it's now the United States. Okay, now a key question that I find the most interesting is why Maduro hasn't been overthrown or fallen yet. And I'm interested in this as a political scientist because it's sort of the most thought-provoking part of the question, and it may lead to rethinking of criteria for involvement or what realistic expectations might be in the future if we're faced with this kind of situation. All right. First of all, I think a very big factor which has not been mentioned until fairly recently is the huge role that these outside, and here I'm including Cuba even though it's in the hemisphere, but the three I mentioned, Russia, China, Iran, the huge impact the involvement of these countries, what they have done, has made, because we're not just, this is not just a U.S.-Venezuela conflict. This is another proxy war. It's like what happened in Africa. It's what happened in the Middle East to a certain extent. But now you're having this proxy war. It's not the old kind of thing where things went wrong in Latin America, the United States would intervene, overthrow the government, or the military would decide, okay, enough of them, you know, they're bringing us to ruin, we'll overthrow the military. Military coups in Latin America now are just about a thing of the past. I mean, who knows, maybe it's back to the future at some point, but as of now, there haven't been military coups. So instead, what's been used are social media, where people take to the streets, and it's so easy to mobilize people who now have Facebook and all of this internet. But in any case, you now have these outside hostile powers being decisive. Russia with the weaponry, for example, was furnishing lots of military equipment. I mentioned, I think, helicopters, jet fighters, and tanks. More recently, what's interesting is Russia seems to be pulling back somewhat, not out of the goodness of its heart, but basically because Maduro can't pay anything anymore for this weaponry and equipment. And in addition, Russia has its own serious economic problems. The second factor Maduro hasn't fallen yet. Underestimating the resilience of an authoritarian regime or a dictatorship, you can use whatever title you want. And it's consistent also with the underestimation of Maduro's determination and lack of scruples to stay in power and willingness to do what the Cubans say in terms of hanging tough. So we always thought that, you know, at some point the dictator gets on an airplane and flies away, and then either the military comes in, or, you know, peacekeepers, or the OAS, the Organization of American States, that's something to work out the deal. There is some rumor that Maduro was all set to go onto a plane fairly recently, and what happened was that the Cubans said, over our dead bodies, you know, you stay here. So, and then, I mean, the amount of violence and torture, the treatment of members of the opposition, the crackdown, the economic crackdown, the attacks against them, the jailing, the torture, that has all risen tremendously over the last few months. So we do tend to we think in terms of limits to how cruel these people will be, but if they have foreign partners, in a sense, or sponsors who say, you know, hang in there and you'll win, you know, the democracies can't keep up, you know, can't match you in this or whatever it is they're saying. Next thing, economic deterioration doesn't necessarily lead the opposition to rise up. When you are in a situation of economic deterioration, you spend all your day trying to find food and water. And, I mean, you've read the stories in the newspapers. That's exactly what's happening. People need to eat. They need to feed their families. They need to take care of things. And so instead of the people rising up, also at the same time, you have the regimes, you see that the regime is more willing to use terror and force against you, which also discourages you. Graft works very important in an important way also, because the regime tries to get as many people to participate in illegal activities as possible with the help of the regime. Why? Well, then if you decide you want to break from the regime has the goods on you, and so, you know, puts you in jail and says, you know, look, you guys, you know, you were trying to steal stuff from people's mouths, food, you know, et cetera. So in a way, if they don't, people who engage in graft and that the military knows about it because they've got people all over the place, if the people that are receiving the graft end up saying, no, this is unsustainable, I don't want to stay here, then they suddenly get arrested for being corrupt and taking stuff, et cetera. So the other thing here is the crucial thing. It's hard to win over the military command unless it's clear that the top levels of the military will have a place in the new regime, despite how horrendous their behavior has been and how corrupt they might have been under this regime, the Maduro regime. So the key here, you know, Guaido, by the end of April, he thought, when he called for an uprising, that this time he thought the military, there was some kind of agreement with the top commander that they would break ranks and come across the opposition. I guess one did, and he's still waiting in Colombia because the opposition didn't rise up. And apparently the military decided that the opposition was too disorganized and that they were scared of what would happen to them and that not enough had been promised to them that they felt could be guaranteed if they broke away from the Maduro regime. So in the meantime then, well, let me conclude this. It's hard to win over the military, as I said, unless it's clear that they have enough incentive to join you. So they have to see that they've got a way out, that they won't be killed in the process or jailed in the process or their family held hostages or whatever. And so they apparently did not feel comfortable and assured of all of this. Then the other thing, there is so much graft going on now in Venezuela, and it's international. It's networks throughout Latin America, etc. So you can have, you know, a tremendous amount of sanctions or deprive the regime of money, as we've seen, has been one of the purposes of the various sanctions, etc., of the Trump administration. But if there are other illicit sources of illicit funds, illicit money, it's going to be a loser. You're going to be playing a shell game, and the money will be moving from one part of the world to another. So the Venezuelan military has a share of any kind of state enterprise. I mean, they are taking money out of PDVSA, the oil, any other kind of manufacturing. It's become a socialist regime, and so the private owners have been thrown out for the most part of the big companies, and the military are running. This is sort of the Cuban model, too. The military is running all this. Okay, the main sources of money, well, fairly clearly drugs, I mean, and that's just pervasive, and they get a cut of a lot of this. Even oil throughout the whole time, even though what little there is now to sort of squeeze out of PDVSA, et cetera, that's still going on. Smuggling drugs, I meant to mention. And a biggie is gold, illicit gold mining and shipping it illicitly to Africa to be refined, and then apparently it's untraceable once the gold is retained. There's been a report, it's called, I don't know this firm very well, but it was in the newspapers, and IBI consultants, I think together with one of the national military universities, they calculated that the so-called network of networks, which means networks that then get into bigger networks, racked up between $10 billion and $43 billion in revenue between 2007 and 2018. And that this money was basically money laundered with the help of Cuba, Nicaragua, Ecuador, Suriname, El Salvador, and the FARC, which is the Marxist guerrilla group that still is operating despite the peace agreements with the Colombian government. I mentioned the gold also. Also, PDVSA and its foreign subsidiaries are central structures for money laundering and corruption throughout Latin America. Now, the regime also, the Venezuelan regime, is using the Cuban intelligence and counterintelligence agents provided. They are embedded within the Venezuelan military and particularly the high command. They are available. They have information on all the families of the high command, and as a result, if you are somehow found out in being against the regime, your family's in terrible trouble too, and you all could end up being jailed or killed or whatever. So this is a military that's being spied on, and so they have to be absolutely sure of what they're being given and who's protecting them if they move to the other side. Finally, the estimates of the Cuban military involvement in Venezuela, there's some disagreements over these numbers. 50 high-ranking Cuban military officers, 4,500 Cuban soldiers in 9 battalions, plus 34,000 Cuban doctors. That's often given in quotes, Cuban doctors. They are doctors, but they have other roles. In fact, Brazil, Bolsonaro, sent all the Cuban doctors out. And everyone said, oh, but then you'll lose the ability to care for the poor and this, that, and the other. And he said, out, you know, because they were all spies and they were playing a double role. All right. Where are we? Oh, okay. And now there are also the Cuban Interior Ministry provides Maduro's personal safety squad. And thousands of other Cubans hold key positions in the state bureaucracies, et cetera. I mentioned that, okay. So let me move, because I only have like 4 more minutes. Possible scenarios. You could do that in 4 minutes, because there's not a lot of detail, and we're speculating here. One scenario is a negotiated solution, and there have been meetings in Norway, and there will be in elsewhere. I happen to be a big skeptic about what you get out of these kinds of negotiations, because there have been loads of negotiations before between the Venezuelan opposition and the Venezuelan and the government. And all the time, whatever agreement it is, when it gets down to the nitty-gritty of either Maduro leaving, which I can understand he doesn't want to do, but even having outside surveillance of the behavior of the election process and the, you know, et cetera, that doesn't work. So each time the opposition has ended and then left because they got nothing. Then, of course, there's the military intervention, and basically this is U.S. military intervention, and something like half of the population of Venezuela that says they want U.S. military intervention. However, President Trump does not want another place that we're going to get bogged down in. And so I doubt that that's going to happen. And I think the argument can still be made, don't even go near that decision yet, unless and until we see how much time, you know, with a little more time, if some of the sanctions really start working better. I mean, Venezuela, it's not going to be an easy country to govern, and we won't go into detail there. But so anyway, the Trump administration is reluctant, and particularly I think the U.S. population, despite the humanitarian crisis, will not back it either. So that leaves the usual third option, which is called muddling through. And that involves waiting to see what the impact of the sanctions will be. It's a race against time. You have to make sure that while you're trying to undermine or wear down the Maduro regime and its handlers, etc., that you can manage to keep the Venezuelan opposition together, because the Venezuelan opposition does not have a good record for hanging in there, and it's like every member of the Venezuelan opposition at some time thinks he could be president, or that's what it used to look like. So now with Guaido, he's managed to have enough of a group around him, But if he doesn't, you know, each time something fails, all of a sudden people decide he's not going to make it. He's not going to last. Do I want to throw my hat in with him if he's not going to make it? And so that there's no good option in Venezuela that I can see at this point. I don't know if I had to guess, at least in the short run, I think muddling through is the option, but that's not really going to solve it either. And I think we're going to have to, I think we definitely should wait to see, give the sanctions, et cetera, a little more time, and then, you know, keep reassessing the problem, and we'll see what happens. I know that's a very unsatisfactory conclusion. I guess I could make one up and say everything's going to be fabulous or everything's going to be horrible and someone else will take it over, but I can't. So I will leave you with the muddling through for now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Very, very interesting. While I collect questions from our members, I always take the prerogative of the moderator and ask the first question. So, what I'd like to ask, I mean, you keep referring to sanctions and the you know, taking time for sanctions to take effect. I know, you know, we had sanctions on Cuba for 50 years and didn't really do a whole lot for us, or at least that's my view of it. But don't the sanctions often hurt the population more than they hurt the leadership? I mean, is this, we're trying to put pressure on the population to rise up, or what, you know, what goal do we have for these sanctions?
I think the main goal of the sanctions is to pull the military or a significant enough part of the military away from its support of Maduro. It's true that sanctions always hurt poor people, but it's not as if the lack of sanctions is going to solve their problem either. I mean, there's not enough food. When you have 3.5 million leaving and things collapsing even before the sanctions, the outlook for Venezuela does not look good. I mean, sanctions worked in the case of South Africa, I suppose you could say. We do have this 50-plus group, which is amazing that all of them joined, and I think the reason a lot of them joined was because the humanitarian crisis was part of this whole Venezuelan kind of military situation. But I can't see any solution, including leaving them alone or letting the Cubans take over or letting, you know, Maduro and, you know, the drug trafficking mafia continue in command of the Venezuelan government, you know, for the foreseeable future. That's not going to help them much either. So it's part of. I think the main priority is trying to get the military to shift or split or something. And I think they want to get the Cubans out of there. And I think that you're going to see increasing sanctions on Cuba. Because without the Cubans, I mean, the Venezuelan military is not exactly a fearsome thing. I mean, they're effective in terms of use of force against poor people who are not armed. But, you know, I remember one time they went to go to the, they said they were going to go and attack the Colombians for doing something or other, and they sent like 10,000 troops, and then they backed off. They're not an effective military except to intimidate their own people who are unarmed and poor.
I guess there's several questions I see on one general topic. The one that seems the simplest is, has the U.S. engineered regime change ever worked out well for the U.S.? I mean, there's other parts of the world, the Middle East comes to mind, of course, is we had all of these expectations for transitions to democracy that just didn't pan out. Is there any hope for a democratic transition in Venezuela right now?
Well, not immediately. If you got to incorporate the Venezuelan military into the top command, into the new negotiated solution, you're not going to have it. In fact, it's interesting. My sense of U.S. policy is that, at least under Trump now, that there's a somewhat of a downplaying of the democracy aspect and a sense of realism that it's not so easy to start off, you know, with a regime transition that leads to democracy, because a negotiated solution, in addition to having to include some the military in some kind of position, is going to have to include lots of corrupt people and, you know, parts of the existing regime. I mean, you're negotiating something with people who don't agree with you and who aren't on your side. So now I would usually say that regimes in Latin America have a greater, well, you asked the question about regime change. Well, the Dominican Republic was one of them that worked out. And I guess that's sort of the most obvious. Panama, when they got rid of, what was it, Manuel Noriega. Mm-hmm. And that's a thriving democracy now, with a thriving economy in the financial sector. A lot of corruption, too. But the part of the definition is of a developing country is that they have underdeveloped institutions, including financial institutions, the rule of law, et cetera. So I think the expectations sometimes are higher than the ability to do it. But in any case, Dominican Republic, now, of course, outside, we occupied Germany and Japan, but I don't know if that counts. But Haiti, we occupied Haiti for a number of years, but it's just too poor, apparently, to make any difference.
There's someone who wants to know, could you speak more about China and Bolivia's role in intervening, as interveners in Venezuela?
China has been more subtle than Russia. I mean, China, to the best of my knowledge, has not been supplying weapons and military equipment, et cetera. Their interests have usually, as they claim, to have been economic, and they have wanted a trading relationship. Now, I don't know to the extent to which the Chinese have changed their behavior, because initially they were being lambasted after a while for bringing their own workers with them, not hiring local labor, for example, taking things out of the country and not showing any kind of corporate social responsibility, et cetera. But they're in a different category from what the Russians were doing, and they're certainly in a different category from what the Cubans are doing. I mean, from my point of view, even though Cuba's the smallest country, Cuba is wreaking the most havoc in Venezuela now. And without the Cubans, you get rid of all the military people, and get rid of all the doctors, et cetera, then you might have a chance to do something constructive. But with the Cubans, forget it. I mean, it's like having their own military power doubled, tripled, et cetera, plus their super-duper intelligence. And they're the ones that are in charge of the electoral rolls. So, I mean, as long as they're in there, it's really a detriment to any kind of transition, let alone a democratic one.
Here's an interesting one on, you know, the situation is so unstable there. What would happen if Maduro were to die suddenly or be assassinated? I mean, would the military take over? Would Guaido
prevail? Well, no, probably what would happen, the military would play a role in picking which horrible successor would come after Maduro. I mean, a lot of these guys are super tainted in the drug trade. I mean, Diosdado Cabello, who's known as a narco trafficker, he was head of the National Assembly or whatever. Anyway, none of these top military commanders is free from being tainted with all kinds of corruption and really dirty kind of behavior. So, but there's no shortage of them necessarily, unless they can find a civilian who'll be just a puppet and who'll be too weak and too dependent on the military.
Here's some. It's really a follow-up to what I've asked earlier, but with so many Venezuelans suffering and struggling to even find food, is the humanitarian cost of muddling through too high?
Well, I mean, look, we tried to send in food, right? And Maduro wouldn't let it come. He stopped it at the bridge. He wouldn't let them distribute the food. So there's a limit to what you can do. Guaido was perfectly willing to have the food distributed, and the military blocked it, said, we don't want it, we don't need it, etc. So I don't see how you save the Venezuelan people without really weakening the military control that the control that the military and its allies like Cuba have over the population. And you have, what do you have? The economy itself, I mean, without, I mean, a country that was 90-95% dependent on oil, and now the prices are low, and the oil productive apparatus is gummed up, and the refineries are like into oblivion. It's going to take whoever is in control. There's going to be a lot of money, a lot of effort that needs to be put in. It was never, it always imported a lot of their agriculture. They always import. I mean, it's not that Venezuela has no land. It's that they decided they had oil, so they could buy whatever they wanted. Now they don't have oil. They haven't really fixed up the land enough or cultivated the land. It's a typical case of an underdeveloped country that has one resource and weak institutions and decides they don't have to do any other thing like be productive in agriculture, et cetera. They didn't do it.
Is there someone asking about the popular support that Guaido has? Given the lack of popular legitimacy for Guaido and the opposition, can there be a practical solution that doesn't include participation of the Chavista movement?
When if there's a negotiated settlement, you're going to have to probably incorporate parts of them. And, you know, you also don't know how many Chavistas are really Chavistas or are doing it to save their necks or their family's necks or whatever. But, yeah, I would guess if they have a capability to vet people, then, yeah, some of them could be included. I mean, those that don't have the most blood on their hands, but not all of them are. I mean, a lot of them are just, you know, they're going to rallies, they're spying to a certain extent in other on the population, on their friends, and this, that, and the other. It's the same as the Committees for the Defense of the Revolution in Cuba. They spy on their neighborhoods and stuff like that. So, but yes, you could find some Chavistas to put in. At the same time, you could also, some of the business people, I mean, they are the typical crony capitalists, the ones that are left. They're making money hand over fist because they've got a special place, you know, to carry on. They've got sort of support to for them to carry on their businesses. And they could be thrown out at any time, too. But if the Maduro regime were to fall or something, some of them, well, first of all, we've got a big population of Venezuelans in Miami. Now, I don't know if any of them really want to come back. But I would guess they would. A lot of them are very entrepreneurial. They're businessmen. So it's not like there are no educated Venezuelans that couldn't come back and try to help out in times of a transition. So I could imagine the Chavistas going in. That in and of itself wouldn't overthrow any possibility of you know, establishing some kind of functioning regime. But it would take more than that.
So it's a little different. You mentioned early on in your talk wanting that the Trump administration wanted to be harsh on dictators and authoritarian systems. How does that comport with what's happening with his views toward Russia or the Philippine dictator or other dictators in the world where we seem to be friendlier?
Yeah, it's not an anti-dictator position. I meant hostile dictators. I don't know if I said hostile dictators, but if I didn't, I should have. I mean, we're friends with Saudi Arabia, too. I mean, I think that, and we've got a working relationship with China, too. I mean, but when it seems to me that when Trump is doing it, he has first established that there are going to be sanctions, and there's a threat overhanging the Chinese. I mean, if they don't start cleaning up their act. They've been getting away with all kinds of stuff since they entered the World Trade Organization. They have not they have not abided by all the different things they were supposed to do, the changes they were supposed to make. Everyone says, oh, look how fast China has grown over the last, oh yeah, it's coincided with the hollowing out of the Midwest in the United States, with loads of factories leaving, with our factories going to China and having their technology stolen. They're required to share their technology. I mean, this is really bad. And there has been no one to stand up for American interest in that sense, in the relationship with China, before President Trump, as far as I can see it. Well, in any case, the issue now is, supposedly negotiations are supposed to start again next week. I don't know, you know, China's economy has declined a little bit. I always say I don't trust any economic growth figures from any dictatorship where nothing is transparent. I mean, who knows? He could say it's growing 10%. He could say it's growing 6%. I don't know. But in any case, there seems to be a consensus that the growth has slowed. So the issue then seems to be China clearly doesn't want to have to pay 25% in tariffs on most of its goods. And Trump put this on purpose because he came to the conclusion that he would get nowhere with the Chinese unless he made it imperative for them to want to get rid of the sanctions that the United States was putting on. So we'll see how that works out. Russia, he senses that with Putin being weak now, the economy not being in good shape, and Russia being far away, Russia has already, as I mentioned, begun to pull back in terms of its aid to Venezuela. You know, I find it very, very interesting, though, that, you know, I remember when Obama was caught on this hot mic saying to whoever was the vice president, Medvedev, I don't know how to pronounce the name, he said, just wait until after I'm reelected, and then we can talk. Well, that should have caused all hell to break out, but it didn't. But when Trump says, you know, let's talk, oh, he's colluding with the Russians, et cetera, I think what he's going to see is what kind of relationship that is to the benefit of the U.S. is possible. I don't mean to the detriment totally. I mean a mutually beneficial relationship, and decide whether or not to enter it. And if he's going to get nowhere with the Russians, there's going to be no agreement with the Russians. But the same people who were all ecstatic about Hillary going to Russia and presenting this reset button, you know, because she was going to reset relationships when she was Secretary of State, she was going to reset the relationship with Russia. People said it was dumb and stupid to hand them this kind of thing, but they didn't say, oh, we don't want to reset relations. Now that Trump wants to try and reset relations, oh my God, he's colluding with Russia, everything's terrible. You know, I mean, I think, give him a chance. The guy knows how to negotiate. We all say, he changes his mind all the time. He keeps people off center, off guard, this, that, and the other. Well, I guess it's part of his negotiating strategy, and I reserve judgment. I mean, I don't often understand what he's doing, but he does get some agreements done. So we'll see what happens. I'm looking particularly at China, if we can get anywhere with China, because that's the biggie. Now, it's not Russia that's the biggie now, but it's China.
I think we have time for about one more question here, and let me follow up then with how the administration, the Trump administration, is dealing with various dictatorships throughout the world. We haven't mentioned North Korea yet in this aspect, but you know our position toward North Korea, which seems to me is a dictatorship that's adversarial to the United States, is much, much different than Venezuela. What's the big difference there? What motivates the difference in those policies?
Well, again, I mean, Trump is trying to see if he could begin some kind of opening in North Korea. It may be impossible, but he's gone further than anybody. I mean, it's been failure after failure, whatever administration that the United States is we're talking about, they've all failed with North Korea. So, okay, I mean, he got to meet with the guy. The guy seems to like him, unless the guy thinks that he, you know, Kim Il-jong, Kim Jong-il, I can't remember their names, but But in any case, he seems to feel that this guy at least wants to keep talking with him. But basically, the issue really is China, because it's doubtful that Kim can do anything without China, because he needs China. So again, that's the other part of it. But I don't have anything against him for trying, and I don't want him to give up anything of our interests. And so far, I don't think he has. So to me, the difference really is, look, we're not going to have a world free of dictatorships anytime in the near future, excuse me. On the other hand, there are bad dictators and there are good dictators in terms of U.S. In terms of U.S. national interests. And so we can start trying to work with ones that, if we could turn them around a little bit, that would be good. The ones that we need to try and make some change in is the bad dictators, but there may not be any opening there. But I don't believe in across-the-board things. We say we're only going to have good relations with democracies. You can't be a world power and only have good relations with democracy. I mean, democracies. We have strategic interests in every area of the world, and we have to figure out how best to protect our interests. And sometimes it involves dealing with rather unsavory people and unsavory countries. Ideally, you can help shape those people, but if you can't, then you have to deal with the enemies of your enemies who might be your friends, you see. I mean, without some pragmatism, you can't be a world power because you can't solve anything. That's why it got me so angry when Joe Biden, for example, I wasn't angry at Joe Biden, I was angry at the people who jumped all over him, his fellow Democrats who were rushing to run off the cliff or something, but who look at Biden, and then Biden admitted that there was a period of his time when he had good relationship with other Democrats who were white supremacists, you know, segregationists, whatever. And this was how many decades ago? Well, what do? You know, you're in the legislature. They were elected. I mean, you cannot have an absolutist policy in terms of how you deal with people whose help you need to get things done. I mean, you try and work around them to a certain extent, but you can't be, I don't think, in a democracy where you need to have no negotiation, et cetera. You see what you can get, and you have to be willing to make some concessions, and you don't concede the most important things, you know, which would really undermine your home position and identity, but you have to be willing to bargain. This is what our system is all about. And the idea that decades later they're jumping on Joe Biden because he had decent relationship with fellow congressmen, I think, frankly, is outrageous. And on that note, I will end.
Well, thank you very much.